Stars Over Surrey with Dave Gematis and John Axtell from the Guildford Astronomical Society.
Hello, I'm joined by John Axtell of Guildford Astronomical Society. Welcome, John.
Hi, Dave.
Now, later on we'll be talking about what can be seen in the night sky for the coming month, but let's start with what's happening in the world of spaceflight and astronomy then, John.
Fine, okay then, Dave. Well, as you know, since the shuttle was cancelled, the only way up to the International Space Station has been by using the Russian Soyuz rocket and the Soyuz TMA capsule, and indeed that's the route that Tim Peake followed a year or so ago. However, the next generation of American spacecraft and rockets that are going to launch astronauts to the ISS are nearing the final stages of development and evaluation. This is under what's known as NASA's Commercial Crew Program, and it's important to them because it's bringing manned spaceflight capability back to the United States. These commercial providers must demonstrate to NASA that their systems are ready to begin regular flights. And two of these demonstrations are going to be uncrewed flight tests, one for Boeing and one for SpaceX. Following that, to get full NASA certification for crew rotation at the ISS, both companies are going to have to launch with crew, a test pilot from each, plus a NASA astronaut. And NASA has just released the schedule for this. So the SpaceX demonstration mission is going to be in February 2018, so that's unmanned, and their crewed mission will be in June of next year. And in the same month, Boeing will make their unmanned orbital flight test, followed up just a couple of months later in August by a crewed mission. So just to compare the two craft, quite similar, both look a little bit like enlarged versions of the Apollo spacecraft with which we're familiar, but the SpaceX capsule is called Crew Dragon. It was also known as Dragon 2, after the Dragon capsule that currently takes cargo up to the ISS. That could take a maximum crew number of 7. And that's going to be launched by SpaceX's own rocket, the Falcon 9, to low Earth orbit, or for other missions, perhaps to the moon, using their Falcon Heavy launcher. Boeing, it's now called Starliner, but also known as Crew Space Transportation 100. Bit of a lengthy name, that. Again, a maximum crew of 7. But a little bit more flexible in terms of launcher, could be launched by the Atlas V, the Delta IV, or even on a SpaceX Falcon 9. So, exciting times ahead. Whilst we're talking about SpaceX, there's been a recent announcement about the way in which the Crew Dragon spacecraft will return astronauts down to Earth. The cargo variant uses a large parachute when it comes back from the ISS and splashes down in the ocean, just like Apollo did. The crewed version will also come down under a parachute, but its initial design included throttleable rocket motors that would be used to lift the capsule from the Falcon rocket in the event of an abort at launch time. And these same rocket motors would have been used to slow the craft and bring it in for a soft landing, again, still under the parachutes, remember, on the ground. Four landing legs would pop out from the heat shield just before landing. Instead, they've now decided that the spacecraft will not land on land. It will splash down just like the cargo variant. Elon Musk, who is SpaceX's CEO, said safety concerns were the reason for this. He also said that the original Dragon landing concept was not as initially useful, he now thought, for getting humans onto the surface of Mars. So this is actually a bit of a disappointment. It's a significant design change that has just got to raise questions about the plans that SpaceX have announced for sending landers to the Red Planet. So, just a little bit further out from Earth orbit, let's talk about something that happened on the 23rd of July, only a few days ago now. Scientists spotted a previously unknown asteroid not far from Earth. They analysed its trajectory And it showed that 3 days earlier, in other words, before it was seen, before it was known by us, it had actually passed quite close to Earth, just one-third of the distance between us and the Moon. Now, that's three times the size of the asteroid that broke up a few years ago over Chelyabinsk in Russia and gave us those tremendous videos and caused about 2,000 injuries from flying glass, from broken windows, etc.
You serious? It came that close to the Earth?
Indeed.
And it was unknown at the time?
Unknown.
Wow.
It seems to have been very dark in colour, which is why it doesn't reflect much sunlight and therefore difficult to detect. But had that entered our atmosphere and broken up in an airburst over a city, an awful lot of damage would have been caused. Now, you remember, Dave, that last month I spoke about Asteroid Day.
Yeah, I bought three myself.
Okay. And that was stressing the need to improve our early detection and tracking of asteroids and to think about what protective action, avoiding action, you know, we might take. So I think this near miss really underlines that excellent point. So let's move out from near-Earth orbit and venture out a little bit further to the Moon itself. Until relatively recently, we've always thought that the Moon was completely arid, parched. And that's what it looks like when you look at Apollo videos and photos. Just rock, just dust. But since Apollo, satellites in orbit around the Moon have identified traces of water deep in shadows within craters at both the North and the South Pole, where sunlight can't reach down to melt it. So that water might have been there since the Moon's formation, or soon after, or maybe brought to the Moon by asteroids or comets hitting the surface. The rock samples brought back by Apollo astronauts are still continuing to be analysed to this day. And in 2009, NASA announced that some of those Apollo samples contained glass beads, and those glass beads resulted from volcanic activity on the Moon. And those beads contained water locked up within the structure. Now, at that time, it wasn't known if this was just a one-off, a rare example, given it was just from one landing site. Now, however, researchers at Brown University in the United States have studied data from several different lunar orbiters and have concluded that these glass beads are to be found across huge areas of the Moon where there's been so much volcanic activity in the past during a period that we call the late heavy bombardment. We are, however, still talking about a very small amount. It's 0.015%, but that is really enough to be highly significant. It's exciting news because it means that water can be extracted from the mantle material of the Moon when mankind eventually sets up permanent bases, not just for drinking and showering, but also for fuel. Perhaps more importantly for fuel, water can be split into hydrogen and oxygen and thus used for fuel, for vehicles, spacecraft, using the Moon as a way stop en route to Mars and the outer solar system. So let's move out a little bit further, let's get to Jupiter, where earlier this month the NASA spacecraft Juno flew over the planet's Great Red Spot at a height of just 5,600 miles above the storm, closer than any craft has ever been before. The data from Juno's main instruments will no doubt be made available shortly, but the pictures taken by something called JunoCam were released almost straight away. This instrument is fairly low-tech in terms of camera types, as there wasn't sufficient payload capacity on the spacecraft for a high-res instrument, which would have been larger with more power demands. So they installed this with a view to publishing the raw data on the web for anyone to access and to process. So several citizen scientists who are expert at using software to bring out the detail from raw images have published some absolutely stunning pictures of the Great Red Spot. Swirling clouds within the spot and a 3D effect showing something of the structure deep within the cyclone. And this storm has lasted for several hundred years already, since men first started turning telescopes onto the giant planet. But it's known to be shrinking and also changing in colour. It's no longer really red, but more of a pinky brown. Well, that's at least how I see it when I look at it through my telescope. And further out from Jupiter, we come to Saturn, where NASA's Cassini spacecraft continues its series of weekly dives inside Saturn's ring system, between the inner ring and the surface of the planet. It's got an instrument on board called the Cosmic Dust Analyzer, and this has been sampling the tiny particles that it's been encountering during its passage near the rings. These are particles from, well, the outer atmosphere of Saturn and ring material falling in towards the planet. The spacecraft's magnetometer has been studying the planet's magnetic field and has returned what seems to be quite puzzling data. The magnetic field doesn't seem to be inclined to Saturn's equator, which is what you would expect if that magnetic field were to be maintained. The field is generated by currents and movements within the core of liquid metallic hydrogen that exists in the centre of the planet. So maybe this inclination is too small to be accurately measured by the instruments aboard the spacecraft, or maybe the field is in the process of oscillating from one hemisphere to another. So clearly further study is required. The Cassini still returns some splendid photographs, and the last one I've seen shows for the first time the haze at the edge of the planet's atmosphere. And remember, that's where Cassini will meet its fiery end on its last dive on September the 15th. So, time now to leave our solar system and talk about deep space. Our listeners will have heard of red dwarf stars and white dwarf stars, but perhaps they haven't heard of brown dwarfs. These are objects that are larger than planets like Jupiter, gas giants we call them, but they're not quite massive enough to become stars. And to become a real star, you have to be massive enough to sustain the nuclear fission of hydrogen. These were only discovered in 1995, and they're thought to be a natural byproduct of stellar formation. You know, bits left over that didn't quite make it. But because of their nature, they're so difficult to detect and to observe because they're so small and so faint. But recently, an international team of astronomers have been using the VLT. This is the abbreviation for the Very Large Telescope, owned by a European space organisation. And they've used this to study these interesting objects and to search for more. And the study has now concluded that there could be perhaps 100,000 million, that's 100 billion, of these in our Milky Way alone. And even that could be quite an underestimate. Now, we have something called dark matter, and that's something scientists can't find, but they believe to be present, because to have the mass provided by dark matter would explain why the galaxy doesn't fly apart as it rotates. So I just wonder whether some of these brown dwarfs, or the sum total of these brown dwarfs, might make up a portion of this missing matter. Just my own idea. Last thing to talk about today, another type of star that have been given the name hypervelocity stars. It's a name given to a class of stars that have been observed travelling at incredible speeds, much faster than anything else in our Milky Way galaxy. They're all blue giants, and there's only about 20 of them known so far. And by hypervelocity, we're talking about travelling at 1,000 kilometres a second, whereas normal stars in the Milky Way travel at about 100 kilometres per second. There have been several theories about them, but all really discounted. You know, one is that they've been expelled by the attraction of the supermassive black hole at the centre of our galaxy, perhaps accelerating them as they pass somewhere near it. Another theory is that perhaps they've been expelled from a binary star system where the companion star has exploded in a supernova, pushing the companion away. However, If those were true, you'd expect these stars to be evenly distributed throughout the galaxy, and they're not. They're all in the same part of the sky, and that is one of the reasons why these theories have been discounted. So a recent study has concluded that these stars are in fact from outside our galaxy and are travelling so fast that they might indeed escape from it when they reach the edge and keep travelling on. They are believed to have come from the Large Magellanic Cloud, one of our Milky Way's satellite galaxies. So you might ask, well, what expelled them from there? But that's not yet clear. But perhaps it's as previously discussed, you know, the interaction with a black hole or a supernova occurring within the Large Magellanic Cloud. The cloud itself is travelling very fast, doing about 400 kilometres per second as it travels around our Milky Way. This and its companion, the Small Magellanic Cloud, are splendid objects to see, but unfortunately can't be seen from Europe as they're Southern Hemisphere objects. I've personally been lucky enough to see them whilst on holiday way down south. So that's it, Dave. My report on spaceflight and astronomy news from the last month.
Thank you very much, John.
The month ahead for Stars Over Surrey.
Now, John, so what will our listeners be able to see in the night sky over the next month?
OK, Dave, so the August night sky. Let me tell you first about some of the constellations that we'll be seeing. Well, we've lost things like Leo and Gemini. They've now they've gone. And Bootes, which was our constellation of the month a couple of months ago, that is now over in the west part of the sky at night time. Last month's constellation of the month was Hercules, and that's about due south at about 10 o'clock. So other constellations nicely on view are Lyra and Cygnus, and we're now starting to get some interesting areas up, Pegasus, the winged horse, and Andromeda, where there are some fantastic objects to be seen. But I'll be telling you about those in more detail in the months ahead. So let's think about the moon. The best time for watching the moon this month would be in the first week, as it gets slightly larger in terms of the area sunlit, because the full moon occurs on the 7th, and so it'll be very, very bright there, washing out a lot of the fainter stars. But again, if you want to be watching the moon itself, then from about the 26th, the first quarter is reached on the 28th. New moon, which is best for observing dark skies, occurs on the 21st. Planets. Mercury, theoretically possible to see it, but you need to have a very, very flat horizon, because it'll only be just over 1 degree above the western horizon at about 9:30 in the evening at the start of the month. So, to all intents and purposes, forget it for a while. Venus, a very bright morning object at magnitude -4. So low in the east-northeast, rising a couple of hours before the sun by the end of the month. Mars, you might be able to catch Mars towards the end of the month, again as a morning object, not that far from Venus as it happens, and about an hour before sunrise. Jupiter, still visible, particularly in the early part of this month, in the evening, but it's now getting lower and dimming slightly. But it still dominates the early month's western evening sky. Easily visible as a disk in binoculars, it's that big, and of course in small telescopes you'll also see the four Galilean moons. Saturn, an evening object, due south as night falls, but still relatively low in the sky, 15 degrees high, and magnitude 0.3. So its rings are tilted very favourably, so it does make a fine sight in a small telescope. Two more planets, of course, Uranus and Neptune, both morning objects and both needing a good telescope and a firm knowledge of where to find them. Things of interest during August. On the 2nd, Venus lies just 2.5 degrees south of one of the Messier objects, M35, an open cluster in Gemini. So remember, that will be a morning thing to find. So find Venus, you can't miss it, and just look a little bit above it, and you should find this cluster of stars. On the 3rd, Saturn is just 5 degrees from the Moon, so that could make a nice picture. On the 7th, a little challenge for you. There's actually a partial lunar eclipse that day, but it won't be visible from the UK in its darker portions. However, when the Moon rises just before 9 o'clock, it will be slightly darker as it's in what's called the penumbral part of the Earth's shadow. So just have a look and see if you can spot that it's slightly darker than normal. The 12th is the big date for the month, though. That's the maximum of the annual Perseids meteor shower. In theory, the best time would be to see it, the shower in the in the morning of the 13th, early hours of the morning. But the Moon will be up by then, so it would wash out the fainter meteors. So best thing to do is, say about 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock, get out there in the garden and basically look towards the north and look up about 45 degrees and you'll see the meteors streaking through the sky. You might get, one every 2 or 3 minutes if it's a good shower. On the 19th, another nice picture, the crescent moon in the morning, just 3 degrees away from the very bright Venus. On the 21st, we've got another solar eclipse. This one, well, it's a total solar eclipse in the United States, and I'm going to be lucky enough to be there to see it, but it won't be visible as a total from here in Europe. From the southwest of England, and that will be the best place to see the partial eclipse, but even from here, you'll see a little bit of the partial eclipse, but it will only be a short period of time that you'll see it. It begins about 30 minutes before sunset, so you need a low horizon. I must point out, never look directly at the sun for things like this. Make sure you wear eclipse glasses, or perhaps project an image. You can make a pinhole in a piece of card and project it onto another piece of card, and you'll see a little segment being bitten out of the sun's disk. On the 25th, Jupiter and the crescent moon are just 3 degrees apart, so another nice picture. Now, we started the month by talking about Venus being near one Messier object, a cluster. On the 31st, it's near another one. This one is called the Beehive, Messier 44, M44, and that cluster is in Cancer. So again, just 2 or so degrees, Venus will be just 2 or so degrees south of M44. I talked about the Perseids, so on the Saturday the 12th of August, Guildford Astronomical Society are going to have telescopes at Dapdoon Wharf in Guildford. The National Trust are holding something called A Night with the Stars to see the Perseid meteors, and we'll be there with telescopes. Not to look at meteors with telescopes, you can't do that, but lie back on a rug. You'll need a rug anyway because it'll be cold, and look up in the night sky for the meteors. But if you get bored doing that, then we'll be showing you deep sky objects through telescopes. That runs from 7:30 through till 10, and booking is essential. It's only £5, but people would need to look at the National Trust's website for Dapdoon Wharf, where there's details of how to book. Now, if you're on holiday, which a lot of listeners will be by August, and you happen to be down in Devon, then I'd encourage you on Saturday the 12th, the same day, to go down to the Norman Lockyer Observatory in Sidmouth. They're holding the Southwest Astronomy Fair, and that's from 9:30 a.m. to 5:30 in the evening. There are going to be planetarium shows, presentations, historic telescope talks, solar observing, trade stands for buying telescopes, etc., special activities for children. So go onto their website, which is www.southwestastrofair.com for booking details. As I recall, it's £8 per adult entry. Meetings at local astronomical societies, fairly thin on the ground this month because a lot of people take a summer break. So there's no meetings in August at Guildford, Croydon or Yule societies. Farnham are the only one who keep ploughing on throughout the year. Their meeting will be at Aldershot Cricket Club on Tuesday the 8th at 7:45. And there it'll be Andrew Collins, one of their own members, talking about relativity. Last thing to point you towards, television astronomy, which you can do from your own armchair. So The Sky at Night will be on Sunday the 13th of August on BBC4 at 10 o'clock, repeated on the 17th, the Thursday, at 7:30. And it's entitled It Came From Outer Space. Sounds like an old black and white cinema film from the 50s or 60s. So here Chris Lintott and Maggie Adarin-Pocock are going to investigate space debris that finds its way to Earth, landing on the surface as meteorites or burning up in the atmosphere. They discuss how these space rocks might carry or might have carried the precursors for life on Earth, and also provide clues as to how the moon was formed and how to find space dust now on the roof of your house. So I must listen to that because I rarely get out to clean the roof of my house and it could be dust from space up there. So, okay, Dave, so that's it for the night sky in August. But of course, I must tell our listeners about my constellation of the month. And this is to, we do this series, Constellation of the Month, to help people learn their way around the night sky. So the constellation I've chosen this month is Lyra. And that's easy to find, relatively. It's going to be the set of stars near the brightest star in the sky at this time of year, which is called Vega. It's one of the brightest stars in the sky. It's the third brightest star in the northern night sky after Sirius and Arcturus. And it's one of the stars that makes up what we call the summer triangle. So it'll be a very useful constellation for people to learn and a star for them to find. So if they'd like to look on the website where we'll find a little video clip explaining what can be seen within Lyra.
Thank you very much, John. That was fascinating. Now, this show will be repeated on Monday night at 11 p.m. and is available after transmission as a podcast. The next edition of Stars Over Surrey will be Friday, 25th of August, and it'll include a special interview with Helen Sharman, Britain's first astronaut.
Stars Over Surrey with Dave Jemetis and John Axtell from the Guildford Astronomical Society.
If you've enjoyed this podcast, why not keep up to date with the Sound of Surrey by listening live at brooklandsradio.co.uk or through our free mobile app.